Before I begin, I want to make a procedural announcement. It has come to my attention that a couple of you sometimes leave after the sermon. As a result, because sometimes you don't come back for a little while, I never get to see you. So I just want you to know that after the sermon, in case any of you plan to leave, I plan to make my way to the door so that I get to say Shana Tova to you on your way to the other service that you will be attending. And by the way, whatever person with a wicked sense of humor put this under the bima today. Exactly. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. If you couldn't see in the back, it was a small bottle of Crystal Geyser. Now to business. My parents were not naive, and they generally didn't say things that they didn't mean. I thought about whether it was a tribute or not to my mother to tell this story, but just as an illustration of how not naive they were, I remember the first time that my older brother from college brought home a girlfriend, and we were sitting around the Shabbos dinner table. And he said to my mother, "You know, it's really cold." So we all went to school on the East Coast. "And I wonder if you would consider getting me an electric blanket." And my mother, looking straight at his girlfriend, said, "It depends if you need dual controls on it." They weren't naive, my parents. But let me tell you something that my father used to say to me all the time. He would say, "David, I don't care what you do with your life. I don't care if you're a garbage man, as long as you're happy." And this is what I want to tell you about that. He was lying. I love my father. He was a good man, but that was absolutely ridiculous. Because if I had come home in my bright yellow sanitation outfit and said, "Dad, I'm happy," he would have said, "Wait," to quote Woody Allen, "let me get your mother's head out of the oven first, and we'll talk about it." Because parents have, whether they want to or not, certain, and by parents here I mean Jews, certain fixed visions for what it is that their children should do. And we, in our turn, inherit those visions, sometimes the same, sometimes different. One thing that I have noticed, which is an astonishing fact, is we all take great pride in how different we are from our parents, and we suffer greatly in how different our children are from us. Again, I suppose it's a general human function, but I want to say only Jews. But we do, whether we inherit these visions or create them, we have very fixed visions about who we are, where we're going, what our characteristics are, how we might change, how we won't change. Over the past several weeks, maybe even a couple of months, I've been watching a remarkable television show from Israel. I've been watching it on DVD. You can get it, I'm told, on Hulu, and you can get it with subtitles. It's called Chatufim. They translate it as POWs. Really, it's people who are snatched. And it's the basis of the English series Homeland, but it's very different. It's about Israeli POWs who are taken for 17 years, and then two of the three of them come home. And unlike the American version, even though there are elements of mystery and thriller, it's really a psychological study of what it means to be in captivity and what it is to return. And so I began to think, what would happen to you if somebody took you from your life and for a year or two or three, you were somewhere else in a room, fed and clothed, and then you came back. Imagine yourself in that room. Think, what would you long to escape from? What would you regret? What part of being there would be a relief because there are things you don't want to deal with and don't have to deal with? What would you miss? There's a very powerful scene where one of the men comes home and his wife, who's not seen him in 17 years, and his children, whom he barely knows, and she's prepared a huge meal for him as a welcome home, and he looks around the table and he says, "You know, I really want to go out for pizza." And what strikes you about it is the things that you think you miss might not be the things that you miss. We found the same thing, by the way, those of you who were here for that extraordinary evening with Louis Zamperini, who survived on a raft longer than any human being in history. And while he had compatriots on the raft, he used to tell them about his mother's cooking every day, even though there was nothing for them to eat. What simple sweetnesses would you miss? Pleasures that right now we stuff down our throats without tasting, but in that room, what would you dream of? Now think of your relationships. What apology is unspoken? What love unexpressed? What didn't you do? Or what did you do? That now that you have the time and space to untangle it, you think to yourself, "My God, why did I bring this person into my life and why did I let that person leave it?" Now that I think for a minute and I see these patterns, why did I behave that way? Now that I have the time and the space to think about it, and if I ever get the chance to go back, what will I do? What have I messed up beyond repair and need to let go? What about your job? You're sitting there and you're thinking of the corridors and the people and the decisions and the demands, and you know when you go back, you won't have to take the job. People will understand. You've been away for a long time, will you? Is that what you want to do? Are you doing what you want to do with your life? There you are, and you get to think about it. And what about other people? Who's going to miss you? After all, we say all the time to people who leave our lives, "I'm going to miss you so much," and then a week later, we don't think about them. A year later, we see them somewhere, and we go, "Oh, I've missed you." "No, I really have." "What's your name?" Who will miss you? Who will forget that you were in their lives, and whose life will be cracked open because you're not there? Because remember, we're not the only ones who change. Other people change too. It's how Virginia Woolf said, friendships end. We change and forget to tell each other. One of the things that happens in the show is one of the captives comes back and he sees this woman with whom he had a torrid love affair. And she invites him to come to her home with her husband and her children. And he goes in and he's sick to his stomach. He can't believe that this woman who was a bohemian and they lived on milk crates in little apartments and now she has a beautiful house and a piano. He can't get over the piano. Because it didn't occur to him that other people change too. And while we're sitting in that room, we have to think, who's going to move on? One of their wives remarries and one doesn't. What do we mean to the people in our lives? And why do we mean that? Acharei moti, after my death, writes Bialik in one of his most beautiful poems. Acharei moti siftu kachali. This is how you should eulogize me. Haya ish uru enenu. There was a man, but now he's gone. Od mizmor echad hayalo. But he still had a song in him. So there you are in that room, and you know you have a song that you haven't yet sung. And if you go back, you're going to get the chance to sing it. But you haven't yet. And now in that room, you have to figure out why. Why haven't you? Those words that you were going to speak, you've got to figure out sitting in that room, why haven't you spoken them? What has prevented you? What has kept you to return to last night at a distance? Now I'm going to perform a magic act. You're back. You're out of the room. You're in your life. You're here. Now, what do? The writer Nabokov, at the beginning of one of his books, says the inspiration for his book was when he read that an ape, under the prodding of scientists for months, made the first drawing that an animal had ever made, and it was a charcoal drawing of the bars of the cage. That's us. For many of us, the greatest reality in our lives are the bars we have drawn on our own cage. And sometimes you have to be captive, literally captive, to see your bars. One of the confinements of Yom Kippur is stay here so that you can appreciate what it is when you get to return to your life. When you can see the crackle and shine and spirit of God in you, because not everyone gets to return to their lives. Look around you. There were people here last year who aren't here. They weren't taken prisoner. They were taken away. But you just returned. Remember what Thoreau said in the most famous self-confinement in American literature when he went away to Walden. This is what he wrote. I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I couldn't learn what it had to teach and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. What you see when the POWs return in the show is that they struggle still with their captivity, but so does everyone else. They're not the only ones in cages. So is everybody they deal with, the cages are just different. The Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism, had a great disciple who took over when he died, the Magid of Mezrich. And someone once asked the Magid, how is it that you became the disciple of the Baal Shem? And he said, this is what happened. I wasn't a Hasid and I wasn't a follower, but I had heard that the Baal Shem Tov could look in your eyes and read your soul. So I went to see him. And he looked at me right in the eyes for several minutes, and then he said the following. He said, once there was a man who was driving a wagon, and the horses stopped, and he whipped them, and they wouldn't move. And he began to pull on the reins, and still they wouldn't move, and he pulled harder and harder and harder with all his strength, and still the horses stayed where they were, and finally, out of exhaustion, he let go, and they ran. When the Baal Shem said that to me, said the Magid, I became his student for the rest of my life. What happens when you let go and you erase the bars? I had almost finished when I was struck by an incredible realization that for some reason had never occurred to me before about why we blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. I always heard and always learned that it was because Abraham took Isaac up to the mountain and there was the ram, and we read that on the first day, and that's from the shofar, is from the ram, and that's why we blow it on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Makes sense. All good. But almost everyone here knows another story that involves shofar. When Joshua surrounds the city of Jericho, he gives everyone a shofar and tells them all to blow at the same time. And when they do, what happens? The walls come tumbling down. In several hours at Ne'ilah, all these kids are going to be up here and they're going to be blowing shofrot. And all of us build walls. Sometimes you have to know what it is to be captured, to know what it is to be free. Because you realize when Joshua made the cities of that wall come down, it wasn't only that the Israelites could get in. It was also so that the people could get out. What are you going to do with your life? Because you're still here. You still have choices. We still have cages. Yom Kippur, we say things that we don't entirely believe. On this day, it's decided who will live and who will die, our fate and our future. But we know that tomorrow and the day after and the day after, if we're lucky, we will go back to our lives. But we can't know it for sure. And it is only a possibility, not a promise. So this is the moment. This is the time to understand we've been returned to life for however long we have. Days, weeks, years. Don't live in a cage. Realize that God gave your soul weightlessness so that it could soar. When you hear the sound of the shofar, let the walls come tumbling down. Be free. Be whoever it is that your soul was given the destiny to be in this world. Imagine what you would think of yourself if you were in that room. The opportunities you would long for. The love you would seek. The problems that would dissolve. And then come back. Live your life. Shana Tov.